Welcome to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. We're recording, weirdly, on the night, Eastern time, late afternoon, my time, Wednesday, April 7th, 2021, because we're doing a live stream for Book Riot Insiders members. We cannot see if there's anyone here yet. Jen Northington is on the booth, as they say, helping us out. I'm Jeff O'Neill. I'm here with Rebecca Shinsky. We're going to talk about book stuff as we normally do, just in a weird time.
Yeah, that's the plan. It's not late enough here for like an after dark recording. I'm not having an adult beverage. I don't know what to do with myself. Oh, we do have a couple people here. Hello to Donna and Amelia. Hey, hey. Hi.
4 to 5 is generally my least productive hour of the day, so we'll see how we're doing here. I put on my black shirt, my AV guy black shirt. It's kind of my go-to here in these sorts of situations. Just going to be a normal show. It's kind of a slow news week. I think we're going to start off the show, do a little follow-up. We're going to do the first segment about maybe future segments in a very meta kind of a move for us. But before we do that, we're going to take our first sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and, oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, just a little bit of follow-up from last week. We put out the call for moms, dads, grads, recommendations, and we got one request so far.
Come on, people.
This is very sad for you all looking for recommendation requests. So we've got one, so we can, although we'll get to all the ones we've got submitted so far.
If there's only one, do we spend an hour picking books for them?
I don't know. It's also one that I won't say what it is now, because if we only have one, then we'll really be boring when we get to it. I've got some ideas, or it's kind of like one we've done before, so I'm not sure. Give us something interesting. Okay. We're looking for stuff here. We can do this.
I mean, we can just talk about how everyone should buy their mom Gilead.
Yeah, we can do that. That's true. We had a very nice email, and I don't think the email was signed, but from a listener who sent a picture of a local bookstore, wherever this person was, with the Four Winds by Kristen Hanna set up in a display. Uh-huh. And the little, it's not really a shelf talker, right? It's just like a staff sticker or a post-it. That said, that one lady liked it, which was an incredible burn to the book. People looking for the book selling so writ great. Large, publishing writ large,
you know,
us for talking
if
about
you wonder-
it.
If you wander into a library right now and you're like, this lady I know recommended a book to me and I can't remember what it is, they're going to hand you the Four Winds and they're probably going to be right.
It's like guessing Babe Ruth and Kennedy on Jeopardy. You may not be right, but it's your best bad guess.
Huh. You won't be embarrassed.
You won't be embarrassed. That's right. Also got way... Look, the Lonesome Dove read-along, Jen, calm down. She doesn't know we're talking about this. That we floated was kind of mostly a joke. We're not going to do a read-along of Lone... Not a joke, but more of a college bull session kind of idea, kind of a thing.
At least that's what we thought.
A lot more emails saying, I would be in for a Lonesome Dove read-along. I appreciate your enthusiasm. For a lot of reasons, I'm not sure it's the book we want to pick for a read-along. As I said before, first of all, it's 894 pages. But I appreciate your enthusiasm. We're going to come up with some new ways to talk about specific books, and we're going to get to that segment here in a minute. But thank you for your enthusiasm. One person called, I think in a good-natured maybe way, our discussion of Mercury a travesty because it was too focused on the cowboy stuff. which I don't know what to tell you. We said Terms of Endearment, and there was a bunch of other books we haven't read. I don't know. I disagree.
Maybe I'll read Lonesome Dove and just give a book report on air.
Also, didn't like that we put McMurtry and John Irving in the same bucket. They're not the same. The point was, they're of an era of especially like mainstream, what do you call it? Jen would know the bookseller. I wanted to keep talking to Jen like she's here, but I'm not doing that. Like upmarket commercial fiction. Like people would read it to be reading things, but not thinking they're reading art books necessarily. It's kind of an older model, especially when it's like white dudes from the 70s. But that's why we put them in the same. But we just don't know how they're going to age. We don't know how those things are going to look under the bright lights of a modern sensibility. So those are follow-up there. I guess other follow-up is we talked about this segment that we're going to continue talking about it. I guess that's the content we're laying down on this fine Wednesday.
Meta-segments is what we're doing.
We're going to talk about, I think we're going to try some of these should I read it segments, mini-episodes, whatever they're going to be. And Rebecca and I want to spend some time together brainstorming title ideas, what also makes an interesting title for this kind of discussion. Mm-hmm. And then we want you listening, or listening live, I guess, as the case may be, to give us some feedback. Is this jives with what it does? And maybe we'll open to some voting. You know, we'll have a couple of candidates. We'll see. But it's a real thing in the world of books and reading that, for whatever reason, a book will become a thing that's out there, that people are talking about, want to read, it's in the zeitgeist for whatever. And let's say for the moment that these are for good reasons, right? We're going to keep these into the realm of, we wouldn't mind talking about this book for 15 minutes or so.
Yeah, if the answer is just no, it won't be an episode.
Yeah, it won't be an episode. But I thought it would be an interesting kind of idea to talk about, A, what kinds of books we're actually talking about, if we're on the same page about them. So our first one mm-hmm. up, and I think I've already roped Amanda into joining me, and maybe us, to do it, is Shadow and Bone by Leigh Bardugo. It's kind of obvious, except I don't think it is at the same time, maybe. Right, Rebecca? Tell me why Shadow and Bone is interesting for us.
You know, the Netflix adaptation is coming out soon. I don't think it's out
April
yet.
23rd.
And we actually, like, this is content straight from the Book Riot staff Slack, because last week I was like, who has read Shadow and Bone and knows me and can tell me if I would mm-hmm. like it or not? And because I'm trying to decide, do I want to read these three books, or maybe I'll just watch the Netflix and see where I go from there. Maybe I won't do any of it. And folks, Amanda and Sharifa chimed in and said, you know, that they had read it, what they thought about it. And then you read it over the weekend. We had some private conversation about it. So I think, like, a buzzy book that is not a definite no, but there's like some caveats of like, you should read it if, is kind of the form mm-hmm. I think the answers to these questions will take. Like, this is a book for this kind of reader. So you should read this book if you tick these following boxes, or you're going to like this vibe. And then you shouldn't read it if that vibe doesn't work for you, or if this kind of content doesn't work for you. Like, I routinely text you, like, this book was great, except a bad thing happens to a kid. You know,
and then I'm like, why'd you even text me? Thanks so much. That's,
just would, to warn here, you off think of it.
Look at this service. Great book you would like if you could read it. Thank you.
Well, you know, if it's on our shared radar, right. I don't want you to go down that path and be surprised mm-hmm. by sad content like that. So I think that's how I've been thinking about this should I read it stuff, is that there are folks in our community who really like it, and there are probably listeners who are just on the fence of like, is this the right thing for me?
Right.
And that's the conversation, is here's why you would read it, here's why you wouldn't.
Because even people who listen to this show or other Book Riot podcasts, welcome to the inner circle of like book nerddom, right? The most likely thing is any book we've mentioned, people won't, more people than not will have not read it. I mean, I'm trying to think of like, what book that's come out in the last 10 years has the highest read-through rate of it? And it's not obvious to me, actually, what maybe like Michelle Obama's book Coming or something like that. I don't really know. So even if it's a really super buzzy book, there's still a lot of people that are on the fence, right? And the buzzier it gets, there's sort mm-hmm. of more people have read it, but then the people on the other side of the fence are joining the fence. So I think there's always an interesting way to talk about it. And frankly, it's also interesting to hear people talk about books you've already read. That's like one of the anti-pattern of book reviews. Like,
that's
here's
true.
This book review about this book I haven't read. I don't know if this review is interesting or not to me right now, necessarily.
And to think about past examples, I think the Michelle Obama one would be an interesting question. Like, in my judgment of this, I don't think we would have done oh, should you read it, about where the crawdads sing. Like, we did a big book discussion about that.
I was wondering about that. Say more about that.
But our shared answer was just like, no.
But then why did we do that?
We didn't know. Like, we just did a big book discussion on it.
So in this case, the segment, we would have read it to find out the answer to the question of this segment, right? Okay.
But I think that we could have done... I think this would have made an interesting episode on 50 Shades of Grey, like, to pick another big buzzy book of the last decade. Like, there were readers for whom that was a really interesting choice, and it did some stuff, like, culturally that lent to new kinds of conversations where I don't think, like, anything new to talk about came out of Where the Crawdads Sing. So I could see, I mean, like, I think Amanda and I did this in my living room, basically. Like, whichever of us read 50 Shades of Grey first was like, well, here's what you'll like about it, and here's what you won't like about it. Do you want to spend your time on this or not? And I could see cases for yes and no, where my personal reading of Where the Crawdads Sing is like, it was like 50 Shades of Grey was so big that even if you only read it to know what was happening in the culture, I think it was worth a couple of hours of reading time. And I did not feel that way about Where the Crawdads Sing.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, again, we're not going to decide if we're going to do this forever or not, but I think it might be interesting to try a couple different things and see what makes for the most interesting conversations to have. Jen here, I see, is well, Jen, you're volunteering your service for the Lonesome Dove read along. Maybe you and I doing a Lonesome Dove, should I read it, would be interesting, right? And sort of, you know, really looking at who might read it. What, so for Shadow and Bone, a bunch of us have signed up to read it. I blew through it. I'm going to keep my cards to my that you keep them here.
The vest.
Chest.
Yeah. Where's your vest?
Right here. I get to do all sorts of hand things.
I'm realizing I usually gesture so much when no one can see me, but now I can see myself.
Well, that's the thing is, again, for people listening to the file, they're not going to get this. Here's how I podcast. You know, I'm like, right here.
Yeah, I'm usually sitting in my chair, like, waving my arms around, making a point about a thing. Yeah. No one can see me.
But I think that, so another thought we had was, okay, you have a, would just the people recording the show have already read it, or would it be interesting for me and Amanda to talk about Shadow and Bone and then have Rebecca there sort of as a discussant, a question that, that every woman sort of that hasn't read it and can ask us questions and ask for clarifications too could be cool.
I think that would be interesting. One of the like variations on this that I've been thinking about is a should I watch it that's adaptations of literary stuff. So when Made to Love by Alyssa Nutting came out a year or so ago, I just missed it when it was a new release, and it's been on my sort of like mental. I'll get back to that at some point. She's just an interesting, weird writer. But now there's an adaptation coming out on, I think it's on HBO Max with Kristen Milioti, and there was this weird, trippy trailer for it. And I was like, maybe I'm just going to watch this. Like, maybe I'm just going to watch it without having read the book. And I would like to have a conversation with someone who had read the book that could talk to me about both.
Right.
Like, do you want to read the book first? Can you just watch the adaptation first? Will the adaptation make you want to go back to the book or not? Like, I'm not sure that I've ever seen an adaptation of something and then gone back to the source.
Oh, really? I do that all the time.
Oh, wait, no. Harry Potter. I was a Harry Potter, and I'm sorry, I know we don't talk about She Who Shall Not Be Named anymore, but that's what happened. I like was a skeptic. Bob's roommate in college loved it, and we went to see the first movie, and I was like, okay, I'm going to read these. But I didn't go back to the first. I've never read the first book. I just picked up the second book
and
went forward.
Yeah, I often...
You do that all the time?
I do that all the time.
I didn't know
Usually if it's nonfiction, though, but that's regression to the mean for me at this point, because I mostly read nonfiction. I guess related to that point with adaptation is adaptations. So say... I'm basically, I think we're like 85% sure we're at least going to do one for Shadow and Bone. Is it more interesting to do it before the adaptation hits or give people a couple of weeks and, you know, catch people after they've, you know, that's how these things go, especially with Netflix when they drop all the episodes at once.
Yeah.
There's kind of like a spike and then it kind of falls back down. Do people get more interested in reading? I guess that's what I'm saying, Rebecca, is like, are people more interested in like the book talk in anticipation of the thing coming out, or is it as it's cresting, like the weekend it comes out, or the next week where they have a chance and they're really coming back to it?
Great question. I think kind of all of it. Like,
that doesn't help anyone. All of it. What is that?
my favorite answer. Yes, and.
There's really two ways of looking at this. Actually, there's two ways of looking at the two ways of looking at it.
Are you making fun of me?
Yes, yeah.
Got you. Well, I think folks who really loved the book are interested in like talking about the book and then doing the movie, or maybe knowing that the adaptation is coming out is a really good push for people who've been thinking about it. And it's like right there for a long time. But I do think that those first couple weeks when an adaptation is out create this space of like, if it's good and buzzy, people are going to either opt into the adaptation and maybe get hooked and go back to the book, or the like deeper nerds among them are going to be like, well, I still have time. I can read the book.
Yeah. First. And because we haven't really paid attention in this way to book sales, where we look at Bridgerton or The Witcher. Those are the ones we've talked about.
And The Handmaid's Tale surged right before the show came out, but it also was conflated with the Trump administration becoming a thing and The Handmaid's Tale becoming popular again. So we don't really know what that would have looked like by itself.
Here's a question that we will not be able to know the answer to because of the way data works, but I'm more interested in your guess than the real answer. What percentage of people listening to this show that will ever listen to this episode in whatever form it takes?
This episode.
Have read 1984.
Oh.
Do you think it's above or below 50% that have actually read it?
Below.
Yeah. So by that
and
logic...
And that has to be on the high
I was
end.
I was trying to pick something like...
Gatsby.
Yeah, Gatsby or... I'm not even
sure. To Kill a Mockingbird.
Dan Brown! From the top rope.
Well, if it's anything less than 100% having read Dan Brown, I'm unsatisfied.
Donna says she likes reading the book after seeing the adaptation. I don't have to think. I'm reading, Donna. I don't know if we have permission to do this. I don't have to think about what everyone looks like and there are new secrets revealed, not in the movie or show.
Interesting.
That's a good point.
Okay, Jeff, these nonfiction that you're frequently doing the adaptation and then the book, I need some examples.
Moneyball.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, stuff like that, it just puts me back into the author's, like the rest of their oeuvre.
Well, the book, especially for nonfiction, it's always the case that there's more in the book than in the adaptation. But with nonfiction, there's more detail and there's more liberties taken, right? Because in the movie Moneyball, the Jonah Hill character is a synthesis of several real people that appear in the book. Because the movie's job is to tell a better story. Yeah, and just see what... I also find the storytelling decisions interesting when you're having... Like, Moneyball's a really great example, because when I was surprised by what the book actually was. I thought it was like the Billy Bean story, and it's not. They chose Billy Bean to coalesce the book around. And no one's better at this than Sorkin, so far be it for me to say whatever, but that's not the only way you could have gone. So anyway, that's a good example of something
and
like that.
Joanna's saying in the comments that they read The Expanse after watching the series and that they would have bailed on the book if it had been the other way around. And I've heard that about The Expanse from several folks in my life, that the show is really great and gave them sort of background
would have
context
bailed on
for
the book if you had. No, that's interesting too. We might be in the realm of the idiosyncrasy majority here.
What else are we doing here, though?
I don't know. I'm just saying. So I think Shaolin Bone, and there's so many adaptations now that just because something's getting adapted does not, by its nature, make it a great candidate necessarily.
Yeah. I think, one of the other books on my list of contenders for this is Malibu Rising by Taylor Jenkins Reid, which comes out this summer, which I read over the weekend. I will not share my take on it yet in case we do the show, but I think a big book by an author who's had a big
book. Sophomore book is a great category for this.
Yeah, sophomore, whatever the other ones are, because she's had a couple, but Daisy Jones and the Six was huge, and she might have had another book between Daisy Jones and this, but Malibu Rising is the next one that I've read. And she's a name, and it seems that each of the novels is pretty different. So what is she doing?
Yeah.
Is this next? Should, if you liked Daisy Jones and the Six, should you read the new Taylor Jenkins Reid?
So to use that example, because we have a couple of sub-examples within there, at some point in the shape of Daisy Jones and the Six, it would have been a good candidate for this, right?
Yes.
Not at the beginning, probably. There's very few debut novels. Again, I'm assuming that we're right, that was her debut novel. I could be wrong about that. But for the moment, let's use that as the thought experiment. There was a point in the Daisy Jones and the Six story that we would have known other people are interested in it. And it would have been an opportune moment to help people decide, as they're hearing about it too, if they want to get on board or not. And then once they have one like that, then the sophomore, like the Vanishing Half last year would have been a good example of this. We had the mothers already. It was interesting. We probably would have done the mothers maybe late in the cycle there. I don't know. But that sophomore, can they do it again is kind of the question. Like, what kind of person are we dealing with here? Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And then I think there's a category of writers for this show, at least, that almost anything they write is fair game. And the new Lahiri coming out in May, I think. I think it's called Whereabouts. It's only 192 pages, so we can get through that quick. You know, the Robinsons, the Whiteheads, the Lahiris, the Zadies of the world. I'm sure there's other some that it's just an event if they have a book out. And people want to know if they want
to
know.
And it's just occurring to me. I think there's another class of book that would be really interesting for this, which is, like, I don't know, for lack of a better way of describing it, the books that I think get mismarketed a little bit that could reach a wider audience than
Do you have an example
the marketing. That? Yeah. So I'll spoil my hand on this because I don't think we're going to do an episode about it. But I'm just about finished with A Little Devil in America by Hanif Abdurraqib. Mm-hmm. And he is a poet and a writer and does a lot of music commentary. And the book is like, has a gorgeous cover, but it's like A Little Devil in America, Notes in Praise of Black Performance. And the title sounds kind of academic. The blurbs are a little on the academic end, but the writing itself is not academic at all. And I think that, I mean, he's getting really great press. He's phenomenal and he should get really great press. But I think the positioning is limiting who really is interested in the book. Like, I think the potential readership is much bigger than the way the marketing positions it. So I would have done a should I read this episode, because I would have been talking to you about, like, well, you're interested in the Harlem Renaissance and, like, this particular period of American culture, and here's what he addresses about that. But it also moves up into these other kinds of Black performance and the difference between performance on stage and performance in your body in the world, and, you know, all kinds of really interesting stuff that could be academic. People have certainly written dissertations about this stuff, but that in his hands is really beautiful and compelling, and there's just so much to chew on.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And
it's
like, it's just not like wrapped up as sexily as I think it could be.
That's almost a you should read this segment, which maybe is related, because
I haven't really thought
of this as like a discovery segment, but it could, an element of that could certainly be the case. I guess my ideal candidate, it sounds like a job description, 3 to 5 years experience, is one where should I read X for the title, and someone seeing the podcast episode title be like, oh, I've heard of that book. Whereas that one, I mean, no shade in the Everglades, but
that's true.
I don't think so.
That's true. Yeah. Maybe I just want some new segments. So
we
should read
that's
this.
A whole different thing. After the break, we're going to do that podcast
do
segment
it.
That we're not going to do. We'll talk about how we're going to put that one together. So that's kind of, and then, you know, the Lonesome Dove category is an interesting one too, or Ramona the Pest would have been kind of an interesting
that
one to
been
do.
Fun. Oh, okay. Let's
or, you know, if there's an anniversary, you know, 100 years, it's going to be, I think it's this year. Let's say it's this year. 42 years since the publication of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. For those of you in the know, you know that 42 is the most important number in that series. So maybe a sort of a catch-up. Like, it's out there in the zeitgeist, but it's now part of the culture. And that it's kind of like those kinds of books, if you haven't read them, they're like, well, when we used to have a Netflix queue, like when you got down to like the 30s, you know, stuff that was like number 30 on your Netflix queue, far enough down that if you're a movie watcher at all, there's always going to be things to jump the queue. So it's just going to be in interest purgatory until you die. But maybe this would be a reason like to shake you out of it. And Lonesome Dove's a good example. Like, probably people have heard of McMurtry and heard of Lonesome Dove and kind of wondered what the deal is with it and what whether or not it's worth returning to. This year, Gatsby was in the public domain. Dalloway's in the public domain this year. So there we could find
I've
reason.
Never read that.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Would you like Mrs. Dalloway?
Let's do this live.
I don't have to think about that.
Okay.
Oh, that's now the only question I want to think about. Sorry, live people. That was me
Maybe
just
we should
that
do
was
a
me
sponsor.
Just doing that was me just getting caught in a loop. Yeah, let's do a sponsor, because that'll give me 2 seconds to recover here and come back. Were we done with that segment? We just ended it because I froze.
Well, have you come up with an answer about Mrs. Dalloway?
Sure. Why not just take 30 seconds to think about whether or not you're going to like it? I mean, you're a smart person. It's a great book. It's not going to be a whiff, necessarily. Will it enter the Shinsky pantheon? That's a high bar as well. I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's a good segment to think about in the future. So email us, podcast@bookriot.com, if you've got thoughts about any things. I guess the data point we really don't have is for there's a buzzy adaptation on the horizon. Are you the kind of person who picks up the book at all of an adaptation?
Mm-hmm.
And if you do, when in the cycle are you inclined to pick it up?
Yeah. And I'm curious from listeners, what recent releases or like summer releases are you hearing about that you're having the should I read it question?
Yeah, are there questions out there for you now?
We could contend with those. Again, podcast at
BookRiot.com. We don't really have a book of the moment, do we? On the literary fiction, or you know, on the commercial fiction, literary fiction side? I can't think of one right now. We're kind of off the socials. Like, we're off the soch, so we're not really seeing that kind of stuff as much.
Yeah, we haven't seen like a big novel of 2021 yet, I don't think, or the big novel. There have been some great ones, but I don't think, I mean, Harlem Shuffle hasn't come out yet, so.
Yeah, I don't, and then on the adaptation front, I know Bridgerton got the Netflix bump, but as these things go, that's it kind of comes and goes.
Ooh, there's a new Lauren Groff novel this fall, and I think Groff is a good contender for should I read it.
I think she is now a really combing with a fine, brushing with a fine, what's that, you comb with a fine comb? That can't be the phrase. That's
fine tooth. You're looking.
You're combing
you're
with a
using
fine
a fine tooth comb.
I know, but you can't say you're combing with a fine tooth comb. That's not right. Anyway.
Painting with a broad brush.
Yeah, you're painting with a fine comb. That's how painting and brushing works.
It's mixed media.
Is it a fish or a penguin? I think Groff is a, you got to be between Lahiri and awful, right? in terms of juice.
Right, because like, Lahiri, we're going to find interesting probably no matter what. But and Groff is a wonderful writer, and her books tend to be very different from each book is different than the ones that came before it. So I think there's interesting land to trod there, ground to, oh man.
I think something about looking at each other means our brain, our cliche generating brains are short circuiting.
Somehow this is even weirder than like recording sitting next to each other in a sweaty apartment.
What was that, like 7 years? Anyway, it doesn't matter.
It was a long time ago. I think that you could have loved Lauren Groff's last book and still be wondering how you're going to feel about the next one. And those are really juicy for like ripe for these kinds of conversations.
Sidebar. Am I the only one that has a hard time keeping Laura Vanderberg and Laura Groff straight?
No. Okay.
You're the only one other here that can respond. So 100% of us agree that I'm not the only one.
I don't think that they're hard. Well.
Oh, you were disagreeing. You're saying no.
Oh, no. I don't think you're the only one, but I'm not one.
You're
of
not
them.
One
like,
of them.
I have a really particular attachment to Laura Vandenberg's first short story collection, so I'm not going to confuse them. But as time has gone on, their styles have converged a little bit, and their interests have converged a little bit, I think, and I can totally
the Laurening. Like, I mean, the Laurening, it's all kind of like coming down.
I can't keep Tom Robbins and Tom Wolfe straight, so I don't have any room to judge
here. That is
here.
Completely wild.
I know. Yeah. I know.
Mm-hmm. Namespace pollution is real for the Loras.
Yeah, I got nothing.
So I'm not sure. I mean, that's kind of a meta segment. It's like, should I read the author? Like, what am I getting into if I'm getting in with Groff or I'm getting in with, Tom Robbins is a good example of what you need some things there.
Oh, Amor Towles. That's an interesting one. Good recommendation, Kate. Yeah. People love the Moscow Gentleman.
Gentleman in Moscow. Yeah. And then The Rules of Civility was the other one, which was the one before, but Gentleman in Moscow was such a big hit that it had the echo boom for Rules of Civility, I believe, is the timeline.
I haven't read any of them, so someone can tell me if I should.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that one sold. We get recommendation requests like that. Comps for
we
that
do get
all
that
the time.
One. That's
so
one of
that's
the,
not as
the ones we that's people are looking bad. For comps for him all the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, I mean the ones on our horizon for sure would be Lahiri Whitehead in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read any of the Tells, so I don't know. But I need that segment for Gentlemen in Moscow.
Yeah. I've got, let's see, who's on my radar? Brandon Taylor has another novel coming out.
That's a sophomore situation. Be very interesting.
That's a sophomore situation. Yeah. And Real Life was like so stellar that I really hope that he can keep that pace up. I subscribe to his Substack because apparently the thing I do now is subscribe to people's Substack newsletter.
It's your pandemic Kindle buying spree, just in the form of literary Substacks.
It truly, truly was. I have no cabinet full of candles, but I've got a lot of Substacks in my Gmail.
You're just sitting there reading your email with the regular aromasphere like an animal.
Look, if you're a mid-list author and you want to send me a weekly roundup of what you've been reading on the internet, I am so here for it.
I guess the other category that's obvious for this is prize winners when the list comes out. Yeah. I saw that... Deacon King Kong or James McBride won the inaugural Gotham Book Prize, which is not on our list because it's sort of there's so many book prizes they generally don't burble up apart from the big ones, but it was a 50K prize and there were some interesting novels on there. And I know what'll happen, that the Nobel Prize will be announced and we haven't read something by that person, generally speaking. So that would be a really good and listener service too, I think, in its own
it'll way. Be hard to top Louise Glick, though, for a Nobel.
Well, here's the other thing. Three of the last four Nobel winners wrote in English? Is that right? I mean, I don't know. Because of late, we've had Dylan, Munro, Ishiguro, and Glick.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is we're probably up to read one in translation if the time... comes. I think we've got a lot of ideas. Well, I think we're thinking about maybe dropping them in as, you know, mini episodes at different times, maybe as a segment as part of a larger show. But we don't talk about specific titles as much as we used to when we did other things on the show. When we had like the new books coming out this week and other things like that, we've kind of devolved. We've morphed into either we don't talk about specific titles or we devote a whole episode to it. Mm-hmm. And the burden of an hour to listen to about a book you haven't read, right? And we look at the download numbers and you guys are listening to them, which is great, but not quite as many as do in a regular episode. But maybe a 15-minute segment where you're like, I'm in for an hour of listening to these people talk about a book I haven't read. Tough hang.
Yeah, I like that.
There's Marlantes. Thank you, Kate.
Oh, no, that came out a couple years ago. Deep River. Oh, that's a year ago or so. Right? But we got listeners recommending stuff to each other in the comments.
Yeah, that's right. They don't even need us anymore. Yeah. The AI has become self-aware. Asimov warned us about this. The news stories this week are...
The news is like a downer, man.
Yeah, it is a downer. How are we doing on time? All right. Let's do one more sponsor and then we'll do a regular news show kind of stuff. Like the swallows to Capistrano, the most challenged book of the year list returns, bringing with it raining crap down upon our heads, just like a giant flock of birds. The most challenged book of 2020, most challenged books of 2020, I repeat at the top. 3 years in a row now. I remember when we first talked about George by Alex Gino being the number one book on this list. Knowing some of the other stories we've talked about of late of anti-trans legislation, book challenges, I'm saddened and completely unsurprised simultaneously to see George by Alex Gino remain at the top of the list. The only good thing about this to me means that enough librarians or teachers are doing the work out there to put it in front of enough people for it to be challenged that often. That's the only silver lining here, is what this sort of is a secondary indicator of.
Yeah, and the list is, I think, more an artifact of 2020 than these lists usually are an artifact of the particular historical events of that year, in that for a couple years before this, we've seen this list shift from being dominated by titles that are related to just like the presence of sexuality to titles that are related specifically to queer issues. And in 2020, it kind of swung back around to George is at the top of the list, but several of these titles are related to racism or are considered, you know, the big anti-racist reading material. And of course, that gets challenged. So like number two on the list is Stamped by Ibram X. Kendi and Jason Reynolds, which is the younger reader's version of Stamped from the Beginning, which is Kendi's huge, you know, comprehensive history of race and racism in America. Jason Reynolds holding down the third spot as well with All American Boys that he co-wrote with Brandon Keeley. And then there's also Something Happened in Our Town, which is a child story about racial injustice by Marianne Solano, Marietta Collins, and Anne Hazard. It's illustrated by Jennifer Zivoyne. That's number six on the list. And The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas is number 10. So we've got four books about race, one about LGBTQ issues, and then a couple classics, To Kill a Mockingbird of Mice and Men and The Bluest Eye, which I guess just find things to object to, people, about these classics. It's interesting. The numbers at the top of this note that the ALA Office for Intellectual Freedom tracked 156 challenges to library, school, and university materials and services. And in those 156 challenges, 273 books were targeted. And I can't decide if 156 is more or less than I would have guessed.
In a pandemic year? I think it's wild it's that many. People weren't in school last year. In 2019, it was 377. So we're still doing half the challenges, and kids weren't in school for like, well, my kids aren't going to school until the Beijing Olympics in 2022, as far as I can tell at this point. But that's a lot of challenges for people sitting around at home. At least
my
first blush reaction was, wow, still we're doing this, even now.
Right. And I think, you know, for very good reasons, maybe the flip side of that is we were sitting at home and people could not look away from coverage of George Floyd's murder in the way that folks could look away maybe previously from other moments in the Black Lives Matter movement and other moments of really race-based violence. And the looking at that led to a very big and long overdue conversation that there's still, you know, a lot of work to be done there. But that conversation gives rise to like, oh, well, we shouldn't teach the kids about these things. So I can see how the list moved in that direction. Of course, it's disappointing to see the list move in that direction. And then number four is Speak by Laurie Hulse Anderson, which I want to talk about for a minute.
Unbelievable language in this. Anyway, go ahead. Yeah.
I'm like remembering that the internet can see my face right now. Banned, challenged, and restricted because it was thought to contain a political viewpoint and it was claimed to be biased against male students and for the novel's inclusion of rape and profanity.
That's a new one. Terribleness. Biased against male students. Okay.
Like, how else are we supposed to eradicate rape culture and talk to boys and young men who are the primary perpetrators of sexual violence?
I don't know.
If we cannot talk about this as a thing that exists and that they are the primary perpetrators of. And like, I get it. If you have a son, you don't want to think about the fact that he could do this kind of thing. And hopefully you're having those kinds of conversations. But it's not the parents having conversations with their sons about consent that I'm worried about here. Like, if we can't put a book that addresses the existence of rape onto a high school reading list, and high school is the age at which most kids are discovering their sexuality and having their first sexual experiences, and consent is a hard thing for adults to navigate well, that this is a travesty. Like, so many of the things that parents say in their objections to these books are just things that are patently absurd. But the idea that discussing rape makes a book biased against the male perspective or the male students, whoever wrote that should be embarrassed to have signed their name to it. Like, shame on you. May all of your efforts fail. It's appalling.
Yeah, they win the Pink Dildo Award for really doing it wrong. In challenging book.
A new annual award from the Book Riot Podcast.
The Turkey of the Year is replaced by the Pink Dildo Award for most outrageous challenge to a book. I'm a little surprised. Again, I don't like to see any of the books here get challenged, but I'm surprised we haven't seen Speak on one of these lists before as we've been doing the show. I just was scrolling back through because I don't remember it coming up before. So that's a lot of challenges to come up and claim the number four spot all of a sudden.
It is. And maybe that's maybe delayed reaction. Maybe Speak was added to lists also after Me Too. I'm not sure how that has bubbled up. The Guardian had an interesting piece this week, because a thing that happens after the ALA releases this list every year is that everybody who covers books then writes coverage of the list. And The Guardian spoke to a couple of authors, and Laurie Hulse Anderson said, and she addressed it, you know, much more concisely than I did, claiming that a book about surviving sexual assault is biased against male students completely ignores that boys, men, males can be victims. To avoid discussion of sexual violence breeds ignorance, fosters perpetrators, and guarantees countless more victims. And so she took a really inclusive point there, that the rape victim in Speak is a girl, but not all rape victims are girls. And certainly there is a way to talk about that with kids as well. And sexual violence committed against young boys is really underreported because there's such a culture of shame around it. So we need to have these conversations with everyone.
Yeah, that's true. And just comparing the 2019 to 2020, I'm not sure how much to read into any year over year change in the list, but it's striking that in 2019's list, 8 of the 10 the reasons for the challenge mentioned LGBTQ plus reasons. 8 of the 10 last year. And in this year, only George by Alex Gino, a top spot.
Beth notes in the comments here that there were challenges of Speak, but the book came out in 1999 and there was a graphic novel adaptation that came out recently. So that might have floated
That might make sense. So, yeah, I think the overt Angie Thomas's The Hate U Give, I think that came out in 2017, has been challenged regularly for anti-police messages. And that really entered in a newer phase of race appearing in these lists. I think The Stamped and All American Boys and Hate U Give are kind of in the similar classes, cohort of books that are talking overtly to kids, to black kids, to kids of all races about racial violence and racial discrimination at this age overtly, where in like Bluest Eye, for example, it's taking a different tact to talk about race and gender. If something's going to be challenged, I'm glad it's these kinds of books, because that means they're getting into schools to be challenged, which I think 20 years ago wasn't going to happen. Wasn't going to happen when I was a kid. They weren't going to do it.
That's true. I'm also really interested in the fact that The Hate U Give, I think, if you're going to find any of these titles to be incendiary, these anti-racism titles, The Hate U Give probably has the sharpest hooks for that. Right. So it's interesting to me that it's lower on the list than Stamped and All American Boys. And I'm wondering, like, maybe Stamped just was so widely recommended and it was new and candy was everywhere that it was just out more. So there were more opportunities for it to be challenged. But the very, like, factual presentation of history and racism shouldn't be shocking. And I'm just genuinely kind of surprised that there were more challenges to just like a history book functionally than there were to a novel that's about Black Lives Matter and specifically about police violence in light of what 2020 was.
Yeah. So I guess I'm not sure that given the Black Lives Matter movement's, you know, ascendancy, or I guess a new wave of consciousness last summer, I guess I shouldn't be surprised that race became the flashpoint for people who want to challenge books about inclusion and social justice. Rather than their attention was turned away from LGBTQ plus matters, at least temporarily, or at least not turned away from, but they were mashing the rage email buttons about other things in 2020.
Yeah. And if 2021 is any indication so far, I think, sadly,
I think we're back to 2019. That's right.
Swing back to being mostly objections to titles that cover LGBTQ issues. You know, yesterday, as we're recording this, the Arkansas state legislature overrode the governor's veto about limiting healthcare access for trans kids. And we're going to continue seeing legislative attempts at this. We're going to continue seeing educational attempts at limiting the conversation. And I hate that that's predictable. Yeah.
Okay, let's see, another news story, and then we'll do a break, and then kind of our interesting, fun story of the week. I'm not sure if this is Dana Kennedy's highest, well, it's certainly her highest profile acquisition so far, who is the new head of SNS. We talked about on the show before. She's probably acquired some other things, but this is certainly the highest profile thing. Two Mike Pence memoirs, one that is the Trump White House years, and one that's a longer sort of memoir autobiography situation. We talk about, you know, we've talked about books that for one reason or another, there's really one reason mostly, and that's because they're terrible people, that get pulled, that we don't want to talk about on the show, that we're surprised or otherwise critical of a publisher being involved with. This is a case where I feel a little bit on the line because the dude was vice president of the United States. It's a historical document. On the other hand, I don't want to see a book by this guy. So I don't know. There's my podcast hot take, Rebecca. There you run with that.
I think the most interesting thing about this story is that Dana Kennedy is the one who acquired it. And this is not what I was expecting from Dana Kennedy's like first big moves as the publisher of Simon & Schuster. I'm disappointed. On the other hand, some publisher was going to publish Mike Pence's books and make a lot of money on them. And not for nothing, the end of Mike Pence's experiences in the Trump administration, especially as colored by what happened on January 6th, could really be
There's a story there. There's a story there.
there's a story there. And, you know, also the publisher has to spin any book like this as being like the biggest thing. But the quote from the press release says that it will be the definitive book on one of the most consequential presidencies in American history. So that sounds to me like we're not getting Mike Pence talking necessarily about what it was like to be Mike Pence for 4 years in the White House. We're getting Mike Pence, I think, talking about the Trump administration and working closely with Donald Trump and what he saw. And his perspective on that could have really shifted on January 6th, and it could have really shifted in the time since. I also think he's trying to set himself up for a run for 2024. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what kind of campaign document this looks like. I mean, we'll see what kind of campaign document the press reports it to be, because I'm not going to read it.
No shot.
I feel like somebody was going to make a lot of money on these, and maybe there's a weird kind of justice in the first black woman to be the publisher
of a major
publishing house getting to take home that paycheck. It's also just a surprising choice.
I think these are going to be big books. And if Trump ever writes a book, it will not be full of truth. Let's put it that way. So I think saying this is the definitive account of the might be true in that regard, because there's a couple of other narrators that could give us more of an inside thing, but they're not going to talk, at least in a way that anyone will believe.
That gives Mike Pence a lot of credit.
I'm not saying it's a lot of credit, but it's more credit than the only rung up the ladder of definitiveness is a pinata of lies. Okay. So, I mean,
Pinata of Lies is a good show title.
It's not bad. I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to be buying it. I don't encourage other people to do it. But these are world historical kinds of documents, and I can understand why they're doing it. I kind of wish they weren't. I'm not real hot and bothered about it, I guess. That's kind of where I come down on it a little bit, too.
It's not surprising that a former president or vice president is going to get a book deal.
No.
Like, no matter what party they're from or what they did in office or achieved or didn't achieve, these people are going to get book deals.
I think that's
4 years or 8 years from now, Kamala Harris is going to be writing books, hopefully while also being president.
Right.
You know, but that's just part of what happens. These folks are going to get book deals. Like, half of the people who worked in Obama's administration got book deals, because I've read all of them.
I think they gave you a book deal as a parting gift. You know, as you were walking off Inauguration Day, they had these contracts just from like sub-imprints of Random House, just kind of pre-filled in and ready to go.
You got a memoir, you got a short story collection.
You got two memoirs. Like, some of them are a couple memoirs. We get the photographer, we get the butlers, we get the garden people.
Right. You know, like, my deep wish is that the second one is going to be Mike Pence being like, watching an insurrection be committed in the Capitol made me rethink what I did for 4 years, and this is my 250th.
That's kind of the
apology.
Sneaky way, and maybe I'm holding on to something here, because if he's gearing up for a 2024 run, there might be the other guy might be on the docket too. So he's got to find a way to run against the Trump-like acolytes. Mm-hmm. And
that's
one
true.
Good way to do that is to throw the empire down in the middle of the Death Star here at the end.
Yeah, here was my road to Damascus
that's
moment.
Right. We don't know. We're speculating now. I think grasping at straws a little bit to find a way to find this to be something other than a sigh-inducing acknowledgement of, you know, what goes on.
It's really the thing that I really want is to like somehow know Dana Kennedy and have a couple glasses of wine with her and be like, tell me how you made this choice.
Yeah. And maybe there's the best way to keep this job is to make a crap ton of money in my first couple years. And
yeah,
you know,
that's true.
There's a real politic to that. Yeah.
You know,
that's right.
Like there is. And if it's not her, it's like a white guy running all of the other publishing houses. So the math there is really complicated. And also, it's unfair to place all of the expectations about changing publishing or changing a dynamic like former presidents and vice presidents get giant book deals, even if you think they're terrible people, on the shoulders of one black woman to rise that high in the ranks.
By the time these come out, that means PRH, SNS will both have the Obama books and the Pence books under the same circus tent.
Yeah.
So we've got elephants and donkeys in that particular circus. All right, Rebecca, is this one of those things, there's like a copycat syndrome? Remember there's this poem that was in Colorado? Like, we have enough, maybe people are off Dan Brown, so we got to go make our own treasure hunt things? What is happening with this trend?
This is a new segment to the podcast that I'm introducing called People Do Things.
People Do Things.
And the thing that this person is doing, so there's an artist named Michael Becker, and he tracked down and purchased a golden casket that was given to France by the UK in 1904 ahead of the signing of some document that ended antagonism between France and the UK.
In all fairness, there's about 300 of these because they got to give one of these to each other every couple years just to take care of some stuff.
And it's a giant golden casket. The scale of the photo
doesn't do it justice.
Doesn't do it justice because it looks like a gravy boat in this piece in The Guardian. But it's worth about £750,000, apparently. Yeah. And Becker has written a book, and it is the prize now. The £750,000 golden casket is the prize for whoever can solve the clues in his treasure hunt book, which is called The Golden Treasure of the Entente Cordiale. There's a French version and an English version. They're coming out on Thursday. So
get cracking, folks. Get ready.
Yeah, they're coming out tomorrow as we record this. So by the time you're hearing this, you can get cracking. Each book contains 9 puzzles made up of illustrations that Becker created and secret texts that are hidden in the accompanying story, which is written by Pauline Dason. So you have to crack the hidden code in the illustration to find the missing text, which will help you solve the conundrum. And what an interesting word The Guardian chose here. Once all 9 puzzles are solved, then you can find where 2 geode crystal keys have been buried. And then after you find the crystals, you have to find both geode crystal keys, then you will be able to put them together to open the cabinet where Becker is keeping the casket. And then you will be in possession of a £750,000 golden casket. Will anyone do this?
Listen.
Will even one person?
14 months now. And I'm like, I ain't got the time for this.
Okay, I was like, are you about to tell me that you're going to do this? Because I'm going to reevaluate some
things. I don't understand. Taxes are too low.
Donna's in the comments saying, I have questions.
I think as an off-brand Sherlock Holmes retelling, I maybe would read this on Libby for free. I'm sure people get into all sorts of things. It's not for me.
Has
I don't know what we're doing
Becker,
here.
Has anyone told this artist the average number of books that are sold for a new
title. I mean, how many people are going to hear about this? Like, I need a documentary about the people that are going to do this. Like, kind of in the, you know, the
and will it spelling take them, like, bee kind of
thing. Like, what are they doing? Like, what kind of haircuts are we talking about here?
There's a montage.
Yeah. There's a lot of, like, empty convention centers with, like, dudes around a table doing this. It makes me wonder, because, like, it just makes me wonder, does this guy...
I think you could just stop there.
Does he want to be the kind of person that... Like, what does he want here? Is this performance art? Is this, I'm a dime store Bond villain kind of a move here, and the casket actually has anthrax in it? Like, what is happening?
Is it a $750,000 marketing campaign?
Yeah.
Because I got news for you about that ROI. There's a ring
in the middle
ROI.
Of it that says drink Ovaltine. That's a deep cut for my Gen Xers out there. Two geode crystal keys is the icing on the rococo cake of strangeness that this is.
It's so weird. And I haven't seen any news about anybody solving the puzzle from the last book like this.
Someone found the thing in Colorado. They did. The poem that was a thing, someone did find that. And it was not a hoax, apparently, because that's always a concern, like, have fun. Go find this thing. Seriously, guys, I promise there's one in England and one in France. And there's this little casket that you can then sell on eBay.
Can we talk about how it's a casket? Like, who wants to win a casket?
It must mean something different.
Is it cursed? This feels like an Indiana Jones situation. Is it cursed?
Now I'm interested.
Wait, I know. It's a complicated revenge plot. This Becker guy has, like, one enemy that he knows is going to be enticed by this casket.
His Moriarty's out there saying, oh, geode keys. You got me now. I'm into geode keys.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Know what to get you for Christmas.
A paper and pencil will be enough to discover some solutions. For others, you will need to do additional research. So I guess it's not like the cross word puzzle in the Sunday Times. It's harder than that. On finding both crystals, which have been buried in chests along with documentation, the treasure hunters will be able to put them together to open the cabinet where Becker is keeping the casket. You could say it requires a new entente cordiale, said organizers. Or even a team of single seekers that include English and French players. The book also contains a history of the entente cordiale, written by British author and historian Stephen Clark, author of A Year in the Merde. Clark said he saw the treasure hunt as a timely reminder that rows about who gets doses of vaccine are temporary hiccups in a long lasting and key.
Oh, so this is diplomacy.
Diplomacy through arcane whimsy. I'm not sure. This is maybe. What if two people each get a key? Donna, I think you've really hit on a flaw in the plan there. We've got an England...
That requires two people to do it.
What if England and France go to war because an English person has one key and the French person has another key?
They have to duel. Yes.
They have to duel.
What if one of them has spent years building up a tolerance for iocane powder? Ah,
what you do not smell is a geode key that definitely is buried somewhere in England.
Wow.
Okay.
Michael Becker, or Michel, I am now assuming, now that I'm looking at the name more closely, is he looks very pleased in this photo in The Guardian, and there's a quote accompanying it that says, he does things that some won't understand, but which amuse him. Which,
not
a bad
way to
live.
You know who else says that? Bond villains. The quest to find...
I stand by my revenge theory.
Becker previously illustrated Max Valentine's legendary treasure hunt book, my French is bad here, The Hunt for the Golden Owl. Published in 1993, it contained 11 puzzles, which, if solved, would locate the golden owl sculpted by Becker. It has never been solved! Okay, great. So we're here almost two decades later, and we're getting a sequel to the golden owl that's never been found. But seriously, guys, I promise the owl is still out there.
There's one out there.
The quest of the golden owl followed the sensation which greeted the 1979 publication of Kit Williams' Masquerade, an illustrated book that contained clues to the secret location of a golden hare. Masquerade sold 2 million copies around the world, with the riddle finally solved by two Manchester teachers in 1982. However, they were beaten to the prize by a reclusive hunter who had found the location through a link with William's former girlfriend. You know what this is? Publishing chasing a trend. That's all this is. Going back to 1979 and the golden hair.
The new Gone Girl.
That's right. This one seriously is real, though. Not the last one. The last one is still out there, The Golden Owl. But
I really like a documentary about the people who's the two teachers who solved the first one.
But then were skunked by someone who had inside baseball knowledge from a girlfriend. It's always the way. There's always some connection. There's always some paramour who leaks something and they short circuit the thing.
It's probably Dan Brown's wife with her new horse
trainer. The horse trainer had some inside dope. Okay, Rebecca.
Wow.
That's our show this week. You can find show notes, bookriot.com/listen. Email us about, we had something we wanted to, should I read this segment? Questions.
What titles would be good for that? What are you wondering about?
When in a hype cycle do you get interested and wouldn't mind an intervention of taste on our part?
I could do a whole spinoff podcast about the hype cycle.
your new Instagram feed, live feed.
Good morning and welcome to the hype cycle.
I thought the horse was for the mistress. I think there are more than one horse, Amelia, in the Dan Brown cycle. The horses are one of those hobbies. You don't just get one horse. It's like tattoos.
Oh, it was. It was. The mistress had horses.
The mistress was a horse trainer.
Right. Yeah. And yes, if you have requests for mom's, dad's, grads,
that's
Mother's
maybe
Day,
the most
Father's
important
Day,
thing.
Yeah. Graduation gifts. If you're planning your summer reading.
That sounds good.
If you are, I don't know, if you want a good book to read in those 15-minute wait periods after you get your vaccines, we will recommend you books, people.
Sounds good.
I got my first shot last week. Those were the best 15 minutes of reading I've spent in a long time. Please get one as soon as it's available to you. We will help you out.
All right, Rebecca.
With books, not vaccines.
Thank you so much. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, y'all.